petaled lotus flower has a particularly close connection with this central organ. The currents flow directly into it and through it, proceeding on the one side to the 16 and the two-petaled lotus flowers, and on the other, the lower side, to the flowers of 8, 6, and 4 petals. It is for this reason that the very greatest care must be devoted to the development of the 12-petaled lotus, for an imperfection in the latter would result in the irregular formation of the whole structure. The above will give an idea of the delicate and intimate nature of esoteric training, and of the accuracy needed if the development is to be regular and correct. It will also be evident beyond doubt that directions for the development of supersensible faculties can only be the concern of those who have themselves experienced everything which they propose to awaken in others, and who are unquestionably in a position to know whether the directions they give lead to the exact results desired. If the student follows the directions that have been given him, he introduces into his etheric body currents and movements which are in harmony with the laws and the evolution of the world to which he belongs. Consequently, these instructions are reflections of the great laws of cosmic evolution. They consist of the above-mentioned and similar exercises in meditation and concentration, which, if correctly practiced, produce the results described. The student must at certain times let these instructions permeate his soul with their content, so that he is inwardly entirely filled with it. A simple start is made with a view to the deepening of the logical activity of the mind, and the producing of an inward intensification of thought. Thought is thereby made free and independent of all sense impressions and experiences. It is concentrated in one point which is held entirely under control. Thus a preliminary center is formed for the currents of the etheric body. This center is not yet in the region of the heart, but in the head, and it appears to the clairvoyant as the point of departure for movements and currents. No esoteric training can be successful which does not first create this center. If the latter were first formed in the region of the heart, the aspiring clairvoyant would doubtless obtain glimpses of the higher worlds, but would lack all true insight into the connection between these higher worlds and the world of our senses. This, however, is an unconditional necessity for man at the present stage of evolution. The clairvoyant must not become a visionary. He must retain a firm footing upon the earth. The center in the head, once duly fixed, is then moved lower down to the region of the larynx. This is effected by further exercises in concentration. Then the currents of the etheric body radiate from this point and illumine the astral space surrounding the individual. Continued practice enables the student to determine for himself the position of his etheric body. Hitherto this position depended upon external forces proceeding from the physical body. Through further development, the student is able to turn his etheric body to all sides. This faculty is affected by currents moving approximately along both hands and centered in the two-petaled lotus in the region of the eyes. All this is made possible through the radiations from the larynx, assuming round forms, of which a number flow to the two-petaled lotus and thence form undulating currents along the hands. As a further development, these currents branch out and ramify in the most delicate manner and become, as it were, a kind of web which then encompasses the entire etheric body as though with a network. Whereas hitherto the etheric body was not closed to the outer world, so that the life currents from the universal ocean of life flowed freely in and out, these currents now have to pass through this membrane. Thus the individual becomes sensitive to these external streams. They become perceptible to him. And now the time has come to give the complete system of currents and movements its center situated in the region of the heart. This again is effected by persevering with the exercises in concentration and meditation. And at this point also, the stage is reached when the student becomes gifted with the inner word. All things now acquire a new significance for him. They become, as it were, spiritually audible in their innermost self and speak to him of their essential being. The currents described above place him in touch with the inner being of the world to which he belongs. He begins to mingle his life with the life of his environment and can let it reverberate in the movements of his lotus flowers. At this point, the spiritual world is entered. If the student has advanced so far, he acquires a new understanding for all that the great teachers of humanity have uttered. The sayings of the Buddha and the Gospels, for instance, produce a new effect on him. They pervade him with a rapture of which he had not dreamt before. For the tone of their words follows the movement and rhythms which he has himself formed within himself. He can now have positive knowledge that a Buddha or the evangelists did not utter their own revelations, but those which flowed into them from the inmost being of all things. A fact must here be pointed out which can only be understood in the light of what has been said above. The many repetitions in the sayings of the Buddha are not comprehensible to people of our present evolutionary stage. For the esoteric student, however, they become a force on which he gladly lets his inner senses rest, for they correspond with certain movements in the etheric body. Devotional surrender to them with perfect inner peace creates an inner harmony with these movements, and because the latter are an image of certain cosmic rhythms, which also at certain points repeat themselves and revert to former modes, the student listening to the wisdom of the Buddha unites his life with that of the cosmic mysteries. In esoteric training there is question of four attributes which must be acquired on the so-called preparatory path for the attainment of higher knowledge. The first is the faculty of discriminating in thoughts between truth and appearance or mere opinion. The second attribute is the correct estimation of what is inwardly true and real as against what is merely apparent. The third rests in the practice of the six qualities already mentioned in the preceding pages: thought control, control of actions, perseverance, tolerance, faith, and equanimity. The fourth attribute is the love of inner freedom. A mere intellectual understanding of what is included in these attributes is of no value. They must be so incorporated into the soul that they form the basis of inner habits. Consider, for instance, the first of these attributes, the discrimination between truth and appearance. The student must so train himself that as a matter of course he distinguishes in everything that confronts him between the non-essential elements and those that are significant and essential. He will only succeed in this if in his observation of the outer world he quietly and patiently ever and again repeats the attempt, and at the end he will naturally single out the essential and the true at a glance, or as formerly the non-essential, the transient too, could content him. Quote, all that is transient is but a seeming. Unquote. That's from Goethe's Faust, Part 2. The German, if I can get it through, is Alles Vergängliche ist nur ein Gleichnis. All that is transient is but a seeming. This is a truth which becomes an unquestionable conviction of a soul. The same applies to the remaining three of the four attributes mentioned. Now these four inner habits do actually produce a transformation of the delicate human etheric body. By the first, discrimination between truth and appearance, the center in the head already described is formed, and the center in the region of the larynx prepared. The actual development of these centers is of course dependent on the exercises in concentration described above. The latter make for development, and the four attributes bring to fruition. Once the center in the larynx has been prepared, the free control of the etheric body and its enclosure within a network covering, as explained above, results from the correct estimation of what is true as against what is apparent and non-essential. If the student acquires this faculty of estimation, the facts of the higher worlds will gradually become perceptible to him. But he must not think that he has to perform only such actions which appear significant when judged by the standard of a mere intellectual estimate. The most trifling action, every little thing accomplished, has something of importance in the great cosmic household, and it is merely a question of being aware of this importance. A correct estimation of the affairs of daily life is required, not an underestimation of them. The six virtues of which the third attribute consists have already been dealt with. They are connected with the development of the 12-petaled lotus in the region of the heart. And as already indicated, It is to this center that the life currents of the etheric body must be directed. The fourth attribute, the longing for liberation, serves to bring to fruition the etheric organ in the heart region. Once this attribute becomes an inner habit, the individual frees himself from everything which depends only upon the faculties of his own personal nature. He ceases to view things from his own separate standpoint, and the boundaries of his own narrow self, fettering him to this point of view, disappear. The secrets of the spiritual world gain access to his inner self. This is liberation. For those fetters constrain the individual to regard things and beings in a manner corresponding to his own personal traits. It is from this personal manner of regarding things that the student must become liberated and free. It will be clear from the above that the instructions given in esoteric training exert a determining influence reaching the innermost depths of human nature. Such are the instructions regarding the four qualities mentioned above. They can be found in one form or another in all the great cosmogonies that take account of the spiritual world. The founders of the great cosmogonies did not give mankind these teachings from some vague feeling. They gave them for the good reason that they were great initiates. Out of their knowledge did they shape their moral teachings. They knew how these would act upon the finer nature of man, and desired that their followers should gradually achieve the development of this finer nature. To live in the sense of these great cosmogonies means to work for the attainment of personal spiritual perfection. Only by doing so can man become a servant of the world and of humanity. Self-perfection is by no means self-seeking, for the imperfect man is an imperfect servant of the world and of humanity. The more perfect a man is, the better does he serve the world. Quote, "If the rose adorns itself, it adorns the garden." Unquote. The founders of the great cosmogonies are therefore the great initiates. Their teaching flows into the soul of men, and thus with humanity the whole world moves forward. Quite consciously did they work to further this evolutionary process of humanity. Their teachings can only be understood if it be remembered that they are the product of knowledge of the innermost depths of human nature. The great initiates knew, and it is out of their knowledge that they shape the ideals of humanity. And man approaches these great leaders when he uplifts himself in his own development to their heights. A completely new life opens out before the student when the development of his etheric body begins in the way described above. And at the proper time, in the course of his training, he must receive that enlightenment which enables him to adapt himself to this new existence. The 16-petaled lotus, for instance, enables him to perceive spiritual figures of a higher world. He must learn, now, how different these figures can be when caused by different objects or beings. In the first place, he must notice that his own thoughts and feelings exert a powerful influence on certain of these figures, on others, little or no influence. One kind of figure alters immediately if the observer, upon seeing it, says to himself, quote, "That is beautiful," unquote, and then in the course of his observation changes this thought to, quote, "That is useful," unquote. It is characteristic of the forms proceeding from minerals or from artificial objects that they change under the influence of every thought and every feeling directed upon them by the observer. This applies in a lesser degree to the forms belonging to plants, and still less to those corresponding to animals. These figures, too, are full of life and motion, but this motion is only partially due to the influence of human thoughts and feelings. In other respects, it is produced by causes which are beyond human influence. Now, there appears within this whole world a species of form which remains almost entirely unaffected by human influence. The student can convince himself that these forms proceed neither from minerals nor from artificial objects, nor, again, from plants or animals. To gain complete understanding, he must study those forms which he can realize to have proceeded from the feelings, instincts, and passions of human beings. Yet he can find that these forms, too, are influenced by his own thoughts and feelings, if only to a relatively small extent. But there always remains a residuum of forms in this world upon which such influences are negligible. Indeed, at the outset of his career, the student can perceive little beyond this residuum. He can only discover its nature by observing himself. He then learns what forms he himself produces, for his will, his wishes, and so on, are expressed in these forms. An instinct that dwells in him, a desire that fills him, an intention that he harbors, and so forth, are all manifested in these forms. His whole character displays itself in this world of forms. Thus, by his conscious thoughts and feelings, a person can exercise an influence on all forms which do not proceed from himself, but over those which he brings about in the higher world. Through his own being, he possesses no power once he has created them. Now it follows from what has been said that on this higher plane man's inner life of instincts, desires, ideas, displays itself outwardly in definite forms, just like all other beings and objects. To higher knowledge, the inner world appears as part of the outer world. In a higher world, man's inner being confronts him as a reflected image, just as though in the physical world he were surrounded by mirrors and could observe his physical body in that way. At this stage of development, the student has reached the point where he can free himself from the illusion resulting from the limitation of his personal self. He can now observe that inner self as outer world, just as he hitherto regarded as outer world everything that affected his senses. Thus he learns by gradual experience to deal with himself as hitherto he dealt with the beings around him. Were the student to obtain an insight into these spiritual worlds without sufficient preparation regarding their nature, he would find himself confronted by the picture of his own soul as though by an enigma. There his own desires and passions confront him in animal or more rarely in human forms. It is true that the animal forms of this world are never quite similar to those of the physical world, yet they possess a remote resemblance. Inexpert observers often take them to be identical. Now, upon entering this world, an entirely new method of judgment must be acquired. For apart from the fact that things actually pertaining to inner nature appear as outer world, they also bear the character of mirrored reflections of what they really are. When, for instance, a number is perceived, it must be read in reverse, as a picture in a mirror. 265 would mean here in reality 562. A sphere is perceived as though from its center. This inner perception must then be translated in the right way. The qualities of the soul appear likewise as in a mirror. A wish directed toward an outer object appears as a form moving toward the person wishing. Passions residing in the lower part of human nature can assume animal forms or similar shapes that hurl themselves against the individual. In reality, these passions are headed outward. They seek satisfaction in the outer world. But this striving outward appears in the mirrored reflection as an attack on the individual from whom they proceed. If the student, before attaining insight into higher worlds, has learned by quiet and sincere self-observation to realize the qualities and defects of his own character, he will then, at the moment when his own inner self confronts him as a mirrored image, find strength and courage to conduct himself in the right way. People who have failed to test themselves in this way and are insufficiently acquainted with their own inner self will not recognize themselves in their own mirrored image and will mistake it for an alien reality. Or they may become alarmed at the vision and, because they cannot endure the sight, deceive themselves into believing the whole thing is nothing but an illusion which cannot lead them anywhere. In either case, the person in question, through prematurely attaining a certain stage of inner development, would fatally obstruct his own progress. It is absolutely necessary that the student should experience this spiritual aspect of his own inner self before progressing to higher spheres. For his own self constitutes that psycho-spiritual element of which he is the best judge. If he has thoroughly realized the nature of his own personality in the physical world, and if the image of his personality first appears to him in a higher world, he is then able to compare the one with the other. He can refer the higher to something already known to him, so that his point of departure is on firm ground. Whereas, no matter how many other spiritual beings appeared to him, he would find himself unable to discover their nature and qualities, and would soon feel the ground giving way beneath him. Thus it cannot be too often repeated that the only safe entrance into the higher worlds is at the end of a path leading through a genuine knowledge and estimate of one's own nature. Pictures, then, of a spiritual kind are first encountered by the student on his progress into higher worlds, and the reality to which these pictures correspond is actually within himself. He should be far enough advanced to refrain from desiring reality of a more robust kind at this initial stage, and to regard these pictures as timely. He will soon meet something quite new within this world of pictures. His lower self is before him as a mirrored image, but from within this image there appears the true reality of his higher self. Out of the picture of his lower personality, the form of the spiritual ego becomes visible. Then threads are spun from the latter to other and higher spiritual realities. This is the moment when the two-petaled lotus in the region of the eyes is required. If it now begins to stir, the student finds it possible to bring his higher ego in contact with higher spiritual beings. The currents from this lotus flower flow toward the higher realities in such a way that the movements in question are fully apparent to the individual. Just as the light renders the physical objects visible, so too these currents disclose spiritual beings of higher worlds. Through inward application to the fundamental truths derived from spiritual science, the student learns to set in motion and then to direct the currents proceeding from the lotus flower between the eyes. It is at this stage of development especially that the value of sound judgment and a training in clear and logical thought come to the fore. The higher self, which hitherto slumbered unconsciously in an embryonic state, is now born into conscious existence. This is not a figurative but a positive birth in the spiritual world, and the being now born, the higher self, must enter that world with all the necessary organs and aptitudes if it is to be capable of life. Just as nature must provide for a child being born into the world with suitable eyes and ears, so too the laws of self-development must provide for the necessary capacities with which the higher self can enter existence. These laws governing the development of the higher spiritual organs are none other than the laws of sound reason and morality of the physical world. The spiritual self matures in the physical self as a child in the mother's womb. The child's health depends upon the normal functioning of natural laws in the maternal womb. The constitution of the spiritual self is similarly conditioned by the laws of common intelligence and reason that govern physical life. No one can give birth to a soundly constituted higher self whose life in thought and feeling, in the physical world, is not sound and healthy. Natural, rational life is the basis of all genuine spiritual development. Just as the child, when still in the maternal womb, lives in accordance with the natural forces to which it has access, after its birth, through its organs of sense, so too, the higher self, the human higher self, lives in accordance with the laws of the spiritual world, even during physical existence. And even as the child, out of a dim life instinct, acquires the requisite forces, so too can man acquire the powers of the spiritual world before his higher self is born. Indeed, he must do this if the latter is to enter the world as a fully developed being. It would be quite wrong for anyone to say, quote, "I cannot accept the teachings of spiritual science until I myself become a seer," unquote. For without inner application to the results of spiritual research, there is no chance whatever of attaining genuine higher knowledge. It would be as though a child, during gestation, were to refuse the forces coming to it through its mother, and propose to wait until it could procure them for itself. Just as the embryonic child, in its incipient feeling for life, learns to appreciate what is offered to it, so can the non-seer appreciate the truth of the teachings of spiritual science. An insight into these teachings, based on a deeply rooted feeling for truth and a clear, sound, all-round critical and reasoning faculty, are possible even before spiritual things are actually perceived. The esoteric knowledge must first be studied, so that this study becomes a preparation for clairvoyance. A person attaining clairvoyance without such preparation would resemble a child born with eyes and ears, but without a brain. The entire world of sound and color would display itself before him, but he would be helpless in it. At this stage of his esoteric development, the student realizes through personal inward experience all that had previously appealed to his sense of truth, to his intellect and reason. He has now direct knowledge of his higher self. He learns how his higher self is connected with exalted spiritual beings and forms with them a united whole. He sees how the lower self originates in a higher world, and it is revealed to him how his higher nature outlasts his lower. He can now distinguish the imperishable in himself from the perishable. That is, he learns through personal insight to understand the doctrine of incarnation of the higher self in the lower. It will become plain to him that he is part of a great spiritual complex, and that his qualities and destiny are due to this connection. He learns to recognize the law of his life, his karma. He realizes that his lower self, constituting his present existence, is only one of the forms which his higher being can adopt. He discerns the possibility of working down from his higher self in his lower self, so that he may perfect himself ever more and more. Now, too, he can comprehend the great differences between human beings in regard to their level of perfection. He becomes aware that there are others above him who have already traversed the stages which still lie before him, and he realizes that the teachings and deeds of such men proceed from the inspiration of a higher world. He owes this knowledge to his first personal glimpse into this higher world. The so-called initiates of humanity now become vested with reality for him. These then are the gifts which the student owes to his development at this stage: insight into his higher self, insight into the doctrine of the incarnation of this higher being in a lower, insight into the laws by which life in the physical world is regulated according to its spiritual connections, that is, the law of karma, and finally insight into the existence of the great initiates. Thus it is said of a student who has reached this stage that all doubt has vanished from him. His former faith, based on reason and sound thought, is now replaced by knowledge and insight, which nothing can undermine. The various religions have presented in their ceremonies, sacraments, and rites externally visible pictures of the higher spiritual beings and events. None but those who have not penetrated to the depths of the great religions can fail to recognize this fact. Personal insight into spiritual reality explains the great significance of these externally visible cults. Religious service, then, becomes for the seer an image of his own communion with the higher spiritual world. It has been shown how the student, by attaining this stage, becomes in truth a new being. He can now mature to still higher faculties, and by means of the life currents of his etheric body, control the higher and actual life element, thus attaining a high degree of independence from the restrictions of the physical body. On page 188, that is the end of chapter 5, the beginning of chapter 6 will begin. Chapter 6, The Transformation of Dream Life. An intimation that the student has reached or will soon reach the stage of development described in the preceding chapter will be found in the change which comes over his dream life. His dreams, hitherto confused and haphazard, now begin to assume a more regular character. Their pictures begin to succeed each other in sensible connection, like the thoughts and ideas of daily life. He can discern in them law, cause, and effect. The content, too, of his dreams is changed. While hitherto he discerned only reminiscences of daily life and transformed impressions of his surroundings or of his physical condition, there now appear before him pictures of a world he has hitherto not known. At first the general character of his dream life remains unchanged, inasfar as dreams are distinguished from waking mental activity by the symbolical presentation of what they wish to express. No attentive observer of dream life can fail to detect this characteristic. For instance, a person may dream that he has caught some horrible creature, and he feels an unpleasant sensation in his hand. He wakes to discover that he is tightly grasping a corner of the blanket. The truth is not presented to the mind except through the medium of a symbolical image. A man may dream that he is flying from some pursuer and is stricken with fear. On waking, he finds that he has been suffering during sleep from palpitations of the heart. Disquieting dreams can also be traced to indigestible food. Occurrences in the immediate vicinity may also reflect themselves symbolically in dreams. The striking of a clock may evoke the picture of a troop of soldiers marching by to the beat of drums. A falling chair may be the occasion of a whole dream drama in which the sound of the fall is reproduced as the report of a gun, and so forth. The more regulated dreams of esoteric students, whose etheric body has begun its development, retain this symbolical method of expression, but they will cease merely to reflect reality connected with the physical body and physical environment. As the dreams due to the latter causes become more connected, they are mingled with similar pictures, expressing things and events of another world. These are the first experiences lying beyond the range of waking consciousness. Yet no true mystic will ever make his experiences in dreams the basis of any authoritative account of a higher world. Such dreams must be merely considered as providing the first hint of a higher development. Very soon, and as a further result, the student's dreams will no longer remain beyond the reach of intellectual guidance as heretofore, but on the contrary, will be mentally controlled and supervised like the impressions and conceptions of waking consciousness. The difference between dream and waking consciousness grows ever smaller. The dreamer remains awake in the fullest sense of the word during his dream life. That is, he is aware of his mastery and control over his own vivid mental activity. During our dreams, we are actually in a world other than that of our senses. But with undeveloped spiritual organs, we can form none other than the confused conceptions of it described above. It is only in so far present for us, as for instance the world of sense could be, for a being equipped with no more than rudimentary eyes. That is why we can see nothing in this world but counterfeits and reflections of daily life. The latter are perceptible to us because our own soul paints its daily experiences in pictorial form into the substance of which that other world consists. It must be clearly understood that in addition to our ordinary conscious workaday life, we lead a second, unconscious life in that other world. We engrave in it all our thoughts and perceptions. These tracings only become visible when the lotus flowers are developed. Now, in every human being there are slender rudiments of these lotus flowers. We cannot perceive by means of them during waking consciousness, because the impressions made on them are very faint. We cannot see the stars during the daytime for a similar reason. Their visibility is extinguished by the mighty glare of the sun. Thus, too, the faint spiritual impressions cannot make themselves felt in the face of the powerful impressions received through the senses. Now, when the gate of the senses is closed during sleep, these other impressions begin to emerge confusedly, and the dreamer becomes aware of experiences in another world. But as already explained, these experiences consist at first merely of pictures engraved in the spiritual world by our mental activity attached to the physical senses. Only developed lotus flowers make it possible for manifestations not derived from the physical world to be imprinted in the same way. And then the etheric body, when developed, brings full knowledge concerning these engraved impressions derived from other worlds. This is the beginning of life and activity in a new world. And at this point, esoteric training must set the student a twofold task. To begin with, he must learn to take stock of everything he observes in his dreams, exactly as though he were awake. Then, if successful in this, he is led to make the same observations during ordinary waking consciousness. He will so train his attention and receptivity for these spiritual impressions that they need no longer vanish in the face of the physical impressions, but will always be at hand for him and reach him in addition to the others. When the student has acquired this faculty, there arises before his spiritual eyes something of the picture described in the preceding chapter, and he can henceforth discern all that the spiritual world contains as the cause of the physical world. Above all things, he can perceive and gain knowledge of his own higher self in this world. The next task now confronting him is to grow, as it were, into this higher self, that is, really to regard it as his own true self and to act accordingly. He realizes ever more clearly and intensely that his physical body and what he hitherto calls his I are merely the instruments of his higher self. He adopts an attitude toward his lower self, such as a person limited to the world of the senses adopts towards some instrument or vehicle that serves him. No one includes as part of himself the vehicle in which he is traveling, even though he says, "I travel." So too, when an inwardly developed person says, "I go through the door," his actual conception is, "I carry my body through the door." Only this must become a natural concept for him, so that he never for a moment loses his firm footing in the physical world or feels estranged from it. If the student is to avoid becoming a fantastic visionary, he must not impoverish his life through his higher consciousness, but on the contrary, enrich it, as a person enriches his life by using the railway and not merely his legs to cover a certain distance. When the student has thus raised himself to a life in the higher ego, or rather during his acquisition of the higher consciousness, he will learn how to stir to life the spiritual perceptive force in the organ of the heart and control it through the currents described in the foregoing chapter. This perceptive force is an element of higher substantiality, which proceeds from the organ in question and flows with beautiful radiance through the moving lotus flowers and the other channels of the developed etheric body. Thence it radiates outward into the surrounding spiritual world, rendering it spiritually visible, just as the sunlight falling on the objects of the physical world renders them visible. And how this perceptive force in the heart organ is created can only be gradually understood in the course of actual development. It is only when this organ of perception can be sent through the etheric body and into the outer world to illumine the objects there that the actual spiritual world, as composed of objects and beings, can be clearly perceived. Thus it will be seen that complete consciousness of an object in the spiritual world is only possible when man himself casts upon it the spiritual light. Now, the ego, which creates this organ of perception, does not dwell within, but outside the physical body, as already shown. The heart organ is only the spot where the individual man kindles from without this spiritual light organ. Were the latter kindled elsewhere, the spiritual perceptions produced by it would have no connection with the physical world. But all higher spiritual realities must be related to the physical world, and man himself must act as a channel through which they flow into it. It is precisely through the heart organ that the higher ego governs the physical self, making it into its instrument. Now the feelings of an esoterically developed person toward the things of the spiritual world are very different from the feelings of the undeveloped person toward the things of the physical world. The latter feels himself to be at a particular place in the world of sense, and the surrounding objects to be external to him. The spiritually developed person feels himself to be united with, and as though in the interior of, the spiritual objects he perceives. He wanders, in fact, from place to place in spiritual space, and is therefore called the wanderer in the language of occult science. He has no home at first. Should he, however, remain a mere wanderer, he would be unable to define any object in spiritual space. Just as objects and places in physical space are defined from a fixed point of departure, this too must be the case in the other world. He must seek out some place, thoroughly investigate it, and take spiritual possession of it. In this place he must establish his spiritual home and relate everything else to it. In physical life, too, a person sees everything in terms of his physical home. Natives of Berlin and Paris will involuntarily describe London in a different way. And yet there is a difference between the spiritual and the physical home. We are born into the latter without our cooperation, and instinctively absorb, during our childhood, a number of ideas by which everything is henceforth involuntarily colored. The student, however, himself founds his own spiritual home in full consciousness. His judgment, therefore, based on this spiritual home, is formed in the light of freedom. This founding of a spiritual home is called, in the language of occult science, the building of the hut. Spiritual vision at this stage extends to the spiritual counterparts of the physical world, so far as these exist in the so-called astral world. There everything is found which, in its nature, is similar to human instincts, feelings, desires, and passions. For powers related to all these human characteristics are associated with all physical objects. A crystal, for instance, is cast in its form by powers which, seen from a higher standpoint, appear as an active human impulse. Similar forces drive the sap through the capillaries of the plant, cause the blossoms to unfold and the seed vessels to burst. To developed spiritual organs of perception, all these forces appear gifted with form and color, just as the objects of the physical world have form and color for physical eyes. At this stage in his development, the student sees not only the crystal and the plant, but also the spiritual forces mentioned above. Animal and human impulses are perceptible to him not only through their physical manifestation in the individual, but directly as objects. He perceives them just as he perceives tables and chairs in the physical world. The whole range of instincts, impulses, desires, and passions, both of an animal and of a human being, constitute the astral cloud or aura in which the being is enveloped. Furthermore, the clairvoyant can at this stage perceive things which are almost or entirely withheld from the senses. He can, for instance, tell the astral difference between a room full of low or of high-minded people. Not only the physical, but also the spiritual atmosphere of a hospital differs from that of a ballroom. A commercial town has a different astral air from that of a university town. In the initial stages of clairvoyance, this perceptive faculty is but slightly developed. Its relation to the objects in question is similar to the relation of dream consciousness to waking consciousness in ordinary life. It will, however, become fully awakened at this stage as well. The highest achievement of a clairvoyant who has attained the degree of vision described above is that in which the astral counter-effects of animal and human impulses and passions are revealed to him. A loving action is accompanied by quite a different astral concomitant from one inspired by hate. Senseless desire gives rise to an ugly astral counterpart, while a feeling evoked by a high ideal creates one that is beautiful. These astral images are but faintly perceptible during physical life, for their strength is diminished by life in the physical world. The desire for an object, for example, produces a counterpart of this sort in addition to the semblance of the desire itself in the astral world. If, however, the object be attained and the desire satisfied, or if at any rate the possibility of satisfaction is forthcoming, the corresponding image will show but faintly. It only attains its full force after the death of the individual human being, when the soul, in accordance with her nature, still harbors such desires, but can no longer satisfy them because the object and the physical organ are both lacking. The gourmand, for instance, will still retain after death the desire to please his palate, but there is no possibility of satisfying this desire because he no longer has a palate. As a result, the desire produces an especially powerful counterpart by which the soul is tormented. These experiences evoked by the counterparts of the lower soul nature after death are called the experiences in the soul world, especially in the region of desires. They only vanish when the soul has purified herself from all desires inclining toward the physical world. Then only does the soul mount to the higher regions, to the world of spirit. Even though these images are faint during life in the physical world, they are nonetheless present, following man as his world of desire, in the way a comet is followed by its tail. They can be seen by a clairvoyant at the requisite stage of development. Such and similar experiences fill the life of the student during the period described above. He cannot attain higher spiritual experience at this stage of development, but must climb still higher from this point. End of chapter 6. I'm on page 202, chapter 7, on the next table.